morning. I can't see you at all. I'm sorry about that, but it is nice to see you when I was down in the crowd still. My name is Brooke Cassie. This is Sean Mashore, and we're the directors of Ananda in Southern California. And it's fabulous to have you here this morning for the first satsang and darshan that we're having with Swami Kriyananda during his stay here in Los Angeles. Swamiji will be coming up in just a few moments to speak to us about his time with Yogananda. And at the end of this program, he will also be answering some questions. So if you are interested in asking a question, we have a little table over here on the side next to the wall where you can fill out a form, write down your question, write very clearly, please, so we can read it, and just put your question in the box. And if we can get to it today, we will answer it as best as possible, or Swamiji will answer it as best as he can. And then if it's not answered, we'll do our best to get it in for the next week. I also want to encourage you that on your way out, there's a book table in the lobby where you can get a free copy of a new book that Swamiji has written called Rescuing Yogananda. And it's a very enlightening and inspiring book that I think that you'll find very, very interesting. There's also many other books written by Swamiji as well as Yogananda back there as well. And last, there's also a table where you can find out information on some of our classes, meditation groups, and other programs and events that will be happening throughout Southern California. You can also register for classes there if you feel to, and ask any questions that you would like. Okay? Nice to see you. Thanks for coming.
We're very fortunate to have with us for the next several months Swamiji, Swami Kriyananda. For those of you who don't know, when we say things like Swamiji, G, the J-I on the end, that's a sign of respect. You'll also occasionally hear us refer to Paramahansa Yogananda as Master. That's Yogananda that we're referring to. We're so fortunate to have this opportunity. This is a rare, rare sequence of talks, classes, satsangs, darshan. You could use all of these different words to describe what is happening here today and what will happen over these next Sundays. In the time that I've been at Ananda, which is around 18 years, I have never encountered Swamiji doing a series of talks or satsangs like this. This goes back, it's been many decades since this kind of opportunity has presented itself to anyone, anywhere at around the world, in all the different locations that Swami is. Ananda has outposts in not just throughout the United States, but throughout Europe and India. And Swamiji spends a roughly equal time divided between India, Europe, and the United States, though I think if you asked him, he would say in his heart his home is in India. And yet, even with all of that and his immense giving and traveling and all the different kinds of special events that he gives, to have this opportunity where he's going to give weekly talks on a variety of different topics based on Yogananda's teachings and also take questions and give answers to the audience is, in fact, a very, very rare and special opportunity. So I want you to know how rare and special it is, and also to enlist your help. We're going to be here each and every week, and we need you to help tell the great people of Los Angeles what's happening here. So by all means, tell people on Facebook, tweet about it, blog about it, text message people, send out emails, or even just pick up the phone and call people, friends, coworkers, family members, anyone you think. Because we're a nonprofit organization that largely runs donation-based, as many of you know, and discovered on your way in here. So we don't have fancy marketing budgets or anything like that. We have you and us sharing together as a community and helping to let people know about what an incredible thing is unfolding here. So in just a minute, Swamiji will come up. I just want to say this about him by way of introduction. You'll get to know him. For those of you who don't know him, over these next weeks, you'll have a remarkable opportunity to get to know him in a very deep way and understand the light and joy and truth and bliss that he brings to us all. But by way of introduction, in a formal sense, let me say the following. Swamiji is one of the last living direct disciples of Paramahansa Yogananda. By that, we mean that Swami was actually with Yogananda, was trained by Yogananda, lived with Yogananda, listened to Yogananda, and has dedicated his life to doing exactly what Yogananda told him to do with it. He was the vice president of Self-Realization Fellowship and was on the board of directors. And then in 1968, he founded Ananda. Ananda is exclusively based on the teachings and practices of Yogananda. We specialize in spiritual communities and bringing Yogananda's teachings into daily life. You do not have to be a monastic, for example, to bring Yogananda's teachings into your life, into your work, into your family, your relationships, and everything it is that we do. And that's really what Ananda is. It's a community of people supporting one another in that endeavor. Swamiji, to help this, Yogananda, one of the things Yogananda told him to do was to write and to edit and to lecture. And in fulfillment of his guru's wishes for him, Swamiji has written well over 100 books. I believe it's around 140 books right now. And he's written 400 pieces of music. He's also taken 15,000 photographs and has in many, many different ways tried to find ways to express and share Yogananda's teachings, whether it's visually or through music or through the written word or through lectures. And so that's what you really see and feel and experience with Swamiji, is that you get that overwhelming, that deep sense of a lifetime of commitment to his own search for enlightenment, for spiritual truth, but beyond that, to share Yogananda's vibration, to share these deep and authentic and proven teachings. And so this is a very rare opportunity that we all have now to experience authentic universal truth in its highest expression. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Swami Kriyananda to the stage.
For that great introduction, you see this tottering ruin come up here. I had a bad fall before I came down here. A couple of weeks ago, I was in a wheelchair, but really, I'm much better now, and I'm extremely happy to be here. You may ask, why am I here? Actually, I was supposed to go back to Pune in India, where we're starting a community. And certain things led me to come here. Now, let me talk a little bit about what those things are. I was, as you know, a part of Self-Realization Fellowship from 1948. Master told me I had a great work to do, and he told me that many times, but always in private, because he knew that I wouldn't be in the organization forever. I had the kind of work to do that needed to be out from under the control of other disciples. I saw his mission and teachings in a much broader light than they did and do. They have said publicly many times that he came to the West to start a monastery. Well, to me, that was like a mighty warrior conquering a kingdom so he could buy a little shack in the country. He had a great mission to do. A very interesting thing was that he used to say to us that he was William the Conqueror in a former life. And I was brought up in the English system. I was born in Romania, went to school in England. And to me, William the Conqueror was one of history's great villains. And to find out that he was my own guru, it was a bit of a shock. I had to rethink my values. And I read up quite a bit on him. And I had one of our members at Ananda, Catherine Kairavi, do some research on his life. And for 10 years she spent that. Finally, her book has come out. It's called Two Souls, Four Lives. Why two souls? Well, a curious thing happened. After his passing, it suddenly came to me in a subjective experience, but a very real one, that I had been his son and heir, Henry, the first of England. And this book makes an extremely strong case for that also. But it shows William to have been somebody who launched a whole new wave in civilization itself. Two historians that I know of have actually made the statement that everything we are today, we owe to William the Conqueror. Seems an extraordinary statement. And yet he influenced. He was what is spoken of in India as an avatar. An avatar, it says in the Bhagavad Gita, that whenever darkness increases and virtue declines, I incarnate myself on earth as an avatar to punish evil. And he doesn't say evildoers, evil, to help to lessen the evil and the influence of evil, and to help to raise the virtue. This was William's job. It was also Henry's job. But William came to, he started monasteries. He united the country of England in a way that it hadn't ever been. And he did an extraordinary work. It was a work that was very, so much of it was just winning that territory. And it was sort of initiative. A work like that needed a pause. And so he had his older son, Robert Curthose, as the Duke of Normandy, and his second son, William Rufus, as the King of England. And to Henry, he gave money. And this was a very unusual thing, because usually he would have made Henry an earl or duke or something. He didn't give him land. He just gave him money. And Henry said to him on his deathbed, he said, "On what shall I spend this money?" And William said, "Don't worry. In the end, you will get both of those, both Normandy and England." Anyway, Henry, when he finally got into power, he finished the work of William. He was probably the most powerful monarch in Western Europe. In fact, he's called that. But he never did what monarchs usually do, which is try to win territory for themselves. All he did was win back the land that had been lost by the ineptitude of his older brothers. But he never had any ambitions beyond that. He had interests, yes. He wanted to help build a highway across the Alps from Switzerland into Italy. He helped monasteries outside of Normandy and England. He was very strong on building monasteries. His closest friends were monks and saintly people. But Henry's life also was completely dedicated to bringing peace. He brought an extraordinary period in England of 33 years of complete peace. That was the only period like that that I know of. And the interesting thing about William is that all his closest friends were saintly people. But 430 years after his death, they exhumed his body and found it to be incorrupt. the greatness of that man has yet to be fully understood. But Catherine's book, Two Souls, Four Lives, is extremely interesting. When Yogananda came to America, he had a job similar to that of William. He was the most popular popular speaker in America at the time. As he toured the country, thousands and thousands of people would come and hear him. He filled 5,000 seat auditoriums with people trying to get in, not able to. He spoke with a very, you might say, rich Bengali accent, but he was understandable. And he spoke really very eloquently and full of joy. But his mission, as I've come to understand, was to change an entire civilization, to bring sweeping change. Let me explain why that is needed today. We've come into a new era called Dwapara Yuga in India. It's an ancient, ancient tradition, but it's one that was shared in ancient times by several hundred other civilizations and countries in the world. That the earth itself goes through cycles of time when there is a rise in consciousness and then when there's a descent in consciousness. It has to do partly with the fact that we are a part of a cosmic environment. And the influences of the universe around us, sometimes the earth passes through a period of a part of the universe that raises consciousness because there's more energy. We know now that people with high energy are the people who have more intelligence. People with no energy, I remember Yogananda discussing that kind of people, sort of like no, just sort of catching flies. It takes energy to be more aware, to be more dynamic and so on. At these times of rising energy, we find higher consciousness. And we have now entered from 1900 on into the new Dwapara Yuga, or age of energy. It's an interesting thing, but the director of the patent office in Washington approached the president, I think it was McKinley, at the end of the 19th century, saying, why don't we close the patent office? Everything that could possibly be invented already has been invented. I don't know if that story is apocryphal or true, but it was certainly so that suddenly, around 1900, an entire new approach to reality took place. I have lived from 1926 on, and it's just been staggering to my imagination to see how civilization itself has become technologically more and more sophisticated. Back in 1948 or 49, I forget who it was, some important person, I think it was not the head of IBM or some, but some other big thing, predicted that someday computers will weigh as little as 1 ton. In 1978, I think it was, the president of IBM said that computers will never be small enough to be in private homes. In fact, I have read also that all this microchip thing came from Roswell when that UFO landed, or rather was crashed, and they found high technology there that has pushed our own civilization fast forward. I don't know, but as I look back and think what life was like in Romania in late 1920s and 30s, it's altogether different now everywhere. Of course, Romania was medieval then, so that's sort of where I've come from, a medieval society. But now when I use computers to write books and to write letters and so on, I'm always having to ask my secretary to come and help me do something. It's just not my world. But I can write much faster. I can write 10 times better. And so it's well worth learning. But we're living in this age of energy just at the beginning of it. It will last in its entirety altogether 2,400 years. Kali Yuga, the Dark Age, lasted 1,200 years. And it's 1,200 years descending, 1,200 years ascending. We're on an ascending cycle, which will then go toward Treta Yuga, which is an age when people communicate more mentally, and then Satya Yuga, where people are more centered in God. So anyway, here we are in this new age, and we see confusion everywhere. It has just appalled me to see, well, you see sculpture, for example. They don't know where to go. And so you have a work of sculpture that maybe just a few pipes. Nothing meaning, no meaning at all. The philosophy is that there's no meaning in life. The philosophy is that evolution is an accident, that the only thing people want is sex, that the only ideals there are to get yours. And this kind of teaching you see across the board. It's just terrible to see how few values there are in literature, in art, in music, in everything. It is really desperately needed that Yogananda has come to bring a true direction to people. And he began by showing the simple realities. What does every man in the world want? Every man wants to avoid pain and to find happiness. It's as simple as that. But he showed that you don't avoid pain by running away from it. You avoid it by learning not to be touched by it. You learn it by, for instance, when I go to the dentist, I don't take Novocaine. And the reason is that I think this is one good way of helping to discipline my will, so that while he's grinding away here and perhaps sweating at the pain he thinks he's causing me, I'm thinking about other things, maybe composing some music or thinking about a chapter for a book or just thinking of my consciousness out here. Then this little body is a little tiny thing. And I find that it is possible in this way to avoid pain. But that's the negative side. The positive side is that all of us are seeking happiness. I had this wonderful experience just a few months ago in Florence, Italy. I was in a hotel there. And at night I dreamed of all sorts of people, all faces, some of them looking gross, some of them looking refined, some of them looking criminal, some people looking in for business and thinking, what's in it for me? And I suddenly realized every single one of those people wants the same thing. They all want bliss. The Swami Shankaracharya, who was on the scene about 2,000 years ago, he said that God is Satchidananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. God is that bliss, and he made us all, he projected us all from his consciousness. It is possible now to understand that we are one in a very real sense. Not that we're human beings, that we like the same things. All of us are manifestations of that same bliss. And you look at yourself in the morning, sometimes in the mirror, and you think, me, bliss? But in fact, all of us are made of that, and that is why we are compelled from our own nature to be seeking happiness. The trouble is that people seek it in the wrong ways. They think they will find it through power, through money, through all the things that people seek. They think to find it through drugs and alcohol. I know it's interesting. We were just talking this morning about how many young people take drugs. I have never done that, but I've been in the room sometimes when people were smoking marijuana, and I felt there was an evil presence in the room. I wouldn't go near it. But this is just one of the countless traps. You see, when God created the universe, he had to project a certain power from that state of oneness out to create all the waves that form the vibrations that have produced this world. This world exists in vibration. Everything in the universe is manifested as a state of vibration. Everything is consciousness, not conscious, consciousness. Everybody in that consciousness, first of all, God manifested thoughts. Then those thoughts, he vibrated more grossly into energy. Then that energy vibrated still more grossly in the form of matter. But now we know through science that matter has no reality. It is a manifestation of energy, and we know that everything is in a state of vibration. So the one ocean of God, you may say, suddenly took on waves at its surface, and those waves are what produced the entire universe. Now, here's another interesting thing. Where you have waves, you have ups and downs. You have duality. Everything is made of duality. And in human experience, what this means is that, well, you drink, then you get a hangover. Everything in life, whatever you do, you get the opposite. If you have pleasure, you'll have to have pain. The more delight you take in pleasure, the more you will have to suffer pain. This is just inevitable. You can't avoid it. And so people for countless, countless lives try the other thing. Nothing works for them. Always the pleasure they have will have its opposite, and you'll have to suffer the opposite. Everything in the end is a disillusionment. And the only people who are really enjoying things is those who live in the hope of attaining it. But all those who have attained whatever they looked for, they put it aside and begin to look for something else. Howard Hughes was the wealthiest man in the world. And some reporter was able to speak to him on the phone just a week before he died. And he said, "Have you found happiness?" "Nah, I can't say I've found happiness." Even his voice said it. You will not find what you want except inside yourself. So the first law in life is to not be involved outwardly in things. Always have a certain mental reserve. Don't let anything touch you inwardly. Don't ever be like those people on TV who jump up and down excitedly because they won the lottery or something. Anybody who reacts with great excitement will have to have a downer. Have to. There's no way around it. So learn to be somewhat withdrawn. Learn to watch life. Learn to enjoy, but always discriminate. When you see a beautiful sunset, admit that it's beautiful. I remember a saint, he was 132 years old in Puri in India, and he said to me, you shouldn't enjoy anything. I said, "What, not even a beautiful sunset?" He said, "No, nothing." Well, I thought, what a dry outlook. That's not what our guru taught. He did say enjoy, but he said enjoy it in yourself. Realize that the joy isn't out there in the sunset, but that it's here in your heart. So whatever you see in life, actually you can find that everything becomes delightful. It really is wonderful to be able to say, what a beautiful sunset, what beautiful people, how wonderful it is to see that we're all brothers and sisters because we're all looking for the same bliss inside. This was my inspiration that night in Florence. The thought that everybody, this is my reason for loving everybody, because they're all looking for the same thing that I am. They may be looking in the wrong direction, but everyone on earth wants that same bliss. It's such a wonderful thought. And you realize that, therefore, everyone is lovable. You don't turn away from a child when it's crying. You try to help it. And so when you see people crying because they aren't happy, when you see people doing things that will make them cry, you don't turn away coldly from them. You give them your love. You try to help them. That's why I'm down here, because I have seen, that's one reason I'm down here, I have seen that this need for kindness, for generosity, for love, is so important. There's another thing that's brought me down here. I was at the Titans of Yoga premiere a few weeks ago, and I was absolutely thrilled to see what a wonderful state of consciousness everybody had. They all wanted happiness, and they knew it, and they were full of that. But what even impressed me even more was that all the teachers of yoga, it's gone far beyond the old "this will slim your hips, girls" stage. All those teachers were very deeply sincere, deeply seeking the truth, and very respectful of one another. Not the old scene where they were all competing with one another. I am extremely pleased to see how that spiritual side in Los Angeles has grown so much. But of course what we're coming to now is an era when the road has bifurcated and there are some people going in that direction, there are many people going in the other direction. I feel that it's very important to be here in Los Angeles, which is really the spiritual center of America. You know the expression La La Land? It really comes from L.A., Los Angeles. That's what I read the other day. But, in fact, people show their ignorance in the things that they're interested in. I don't show my ignorance as an engineer because I don't know anything. But when you are interested, then you show your follies as well as your good side. And the truth is that there is deep sincerity in Los Angeles among those who are seeking. Why haven't I come here sooner? You'd think that I would have begun my work here. Well, when I was in SRF, as I've said, I had a different vision. I saw Master as being for the world. I wanted to reach out and touch everybody. I had so many creative ideas there that it sort of was a too stark a contrast to everybody else there who just felt that they were serving our guru if they had a beautiful lawn at Mount Washington. And when I was in India, I wanted to build something in New Delhi because Calcutta at that time, our work there was dead. It went nowhere. But in Delhi, I found I had crowds of 2,000 and more people. And I realized that there, in the north of India, we could really do something. So finally I did. And it was a great thing that I accomplished because 1,700 societies had tried to get land where I tried to get it. All of them were turned down. But Nehru himself, the Prime Minister of India, gave me his permission to build on 25 acres of their greenbelt area. The directors back home were so absolutely outraged at this sudden demand for an outburst of energy that they were furious with me, absolutely livid with anger. And after a few months of downhill slide, they called me to New York and threw me out on my ear with only the money in my wallet. Well, this was a very sad period for me, but I found it was the greatest blessing that could have come, because it freed me in a way that I never would have chosen on my own. I was loyal to them because it was my guru's work. I was loyal and would never have left them, but Master forced me out so that I could do the work that he had told me to do. So I never came down here. I didn't want to interfere with their work. I wanted in every way to help to show respect for that work. And I would require of our members that they take the SRF lessons. I would send them down here. And if invariably when they came, they were had long lectures not to have anything to do with me, I didn't mind. I still kept it up because I believe in the teaching, yata dharma stata jaya. Where there is right action, there is victory. So I tried always to support them. I sent them donations. They weren't received or accepted. I sent people to them. I've sent them about 12 people who became monks here. But always it turned out that there was no opening for me. So this is why I respectfully stayed away from Los Angeles. And I started a community up in the north of California. I started it in near Nevada City. That's our main community. Then Sacramento, Palo Alto, Portland, Oakland. Then people had been inviting me to Italy. I didn't know why they kept inviting me there. It was the one language around that I didn't know. I knew Romanian, French, German, Spanish. I didn't know Italian at all, except for, yes, I had taken a short course in conversational Italian in college, but it didn't linger as a means of giving lectures in the language. I remember, incidentally, there was just a funny sideline. In that class, there was a boy, Kimball Dyer, who was always in dire straits. And I remember one time, we were in the East Coast, and we were all men's college, so I was supposed to be a soldier leaving San Francisco for the Pacific War Theater, and he was supposed to be my girlfriend. And I was to call him from San Francisco by phone before I left the country. So I knew what a hopeless fellow the poor guy was in speaking the language. So I spoke for 2.5 minutes. We were only allowed 3 minutes on the phone. So I spoke for 2.5 minutes just to give him a chance to say as little as he needed to. And I talked about how I'd miss her and all these things. Then at the end of 2.5 minutes, he said, repeta per favore. Please repeat everything. Anyway, that was an amusing sidelight. And I didn't know Italian when I went there. Oh, yes, I studied songs when I learned voice. And in that, I had to sing a few Italian songs. But that's all. Why did they keep inviting me back there? But finally, I decided that Master had said he said, maybe I'll send you to Europe someday. So I decided I would go and give it a try. And I did learn Italian. In fact, I speak it fairly well now. People often ask me if I'm Italian. But, Italians ask me that. I should make that clear. Anyway, we have a center there near Assisi now. And we have several hundred acres of land. And people come from all over, as far away as Russia and so on. And it's a wonderful center. Then we also have one in Gurgaon, which is outside New Delhi. And finally now we're building one near Pune. But I didn't ever think of coming here until it began to seem as if it would help to at least get a toehold in Los Angeles, to sort of sniff the territory out, mainly for this reason. Not only that Los Angeles is obviously the place to come in America if you want to do a spiritual work, but also because more and more people kept coming to us and talking about the disillusionment they were having with SRF. And because of that, I finally sent a couple down. Then I sent Sean and Brooke down, and they're really go-getters, and they're doing a very good work down here. But then last year, Sean invited me to speak at the Ford Amphitheater. So I said, okay, I'll give it a try. We're all just sort of putting our toes in the water to see if it's not too cold. And finally this year, I decided my prime motive for coming here was that I keep hearing stories about how people turning away from SRF turn away from Yogananda. How people hear that Yogananda was a sort of a tyrannical bully, disciplinarian, very strict, very no sense of humor, no sense of warmth. It's so much the opposite of everything I knew who lived with him closely. I'm one, as Sean was saying, of only five other still living disciples. And I'm the only one in the public eye. And it just hurts me to hear him described in such ways. So I thought, I must come to Los Angeles. I don't want to talk about SRF. I've written that paper that you see there. I've had to talk about Daya because she's the president. And whatever the head of an organization is, the whole organization reflects that same spirit. Otherwise, as far as Daya is concerned, we were close friends. We aren't now, but I still love her. I still love them. I have nothing against them. Why should I have? Whatever I have in my own heart is my happiness. Why should I threaten that happiness by negative feelings? If people don't want to love me, I prefer to love them for the simple reason, if no other, that I'm happy when I love, and I'm not happy if I don't love. So I've continued to love them. It's driven them crazy, but nonetheless, I do continue to love them sincerely, and I would do anything to help them. So that book was not in any way intended to be destructive. It is intended to help change the direction, because I think that of all the disciples, I'm the only one who can do it if it's possible. I owe it to them to try. I owe it to Master to try. But on the other hand, I don't want to talk about them when I'm here. I want to talk about Master, about the man I knew, the bliss, the joy, the love, everything. I've never met a more perfect human being than Paramahansa Yogananda. Let me tell you a little bit about how I came to him. I was very young, at the age of 13. In fact, much earlier than that, my search in life was for truth. Truth has been all my life, my God. And I didn't want to go to the churches. I was turned away from the churches. None of them were seeking God. None of them were doing anything. In fact, I questioned whether God even exists. But I wanted to find something that will help to uplift the consciousness of people. I thought maybe the stars, with their vastness and everything, would help to break our consciousness away from the pettiness of life here on Earth. And I wanted to be an astronomer. Curiously, another incarnation of mine, I was an astronomer. Anyway, I finally realized that it doesn't really matter how many stars there are out there, or whether there be one galaxy or 100 billion that they've now found. And so I thought, well, maybe political systems will be the answer. And I looked into that and I realized that people are no better than themselves. Systems will not make them better. They can improve the system, but it has to begin with the individual. So I left political thinking, and I turned to music and the arts. But I saw that, think of Shakespeare, great as he was, has he really had the impact on human nature to uplift it and change it? No. No artist has ever had a significant impact, except that his work is beautiful, people love it and are inspired, but it hasn't had the kind of impact I wanted to make on the world, because I wanted this world to come out of its suffering and to find happiness. And I realized that my real goal was to seek happiness and to help other people to find it also. And I remember every single thing. I wanted to become a playwright and a poet. And I thought through plays maybe I could help to uplift people, until I understood first that people aren't much changed by those things. But secondly, I also realized that I myself didn't know the truth. So how could I flood the world with my ignorance? What good do it do to anybody? I had a singing teacher. She was 75 years old. And she said, I'm living for only one thing, and that's to see you become a great singer. It's the last time I ever went back to her. I felt badly, but I didn't want to be a singer. What would I sing? The words, even they may sound exalted, but for example, a classical song in Italian, beautiful. O cessate di piagarmi, o lasciatemi morire. Oh, stop bugging me and let me die. What kind of a message is that? And I thought, this is not worthwhile. I would only be showing off my voice. What's the use of that? And so I just couldn't even think of going in that direction. But bit by bit, I realized everything leads to this one thought, God. What is God? I keep coming to this thing, but I don't know what he is. And I remember one night I was in Charleston, South Carolina, studying stagecraft. And I took a long walk out into the night. And I asked myself this question, if there's a God, what must he be? Well, first of all, he can't be a he. We have women too. It can't be just one sex. It's got to be something else. He can't be a judge waiting for people to make mistakes so he can clap us into eternal prison. He's got to be something. What is making me ask this question? And I said, because I'm conscious. And my consciousness can't be something that science tells you that is a product of movements of energy in the brain, like a robot. You can program a robot, perhaps, to eat, but you can't program a robot to ask questions like this. You can't make it conscious in that way. And so I thought, I'm asking this question because I am conscious, myself, me. It's my consciousness. It has nothing to do with my brain. And then I thought, well, if this is true, then God must be consciousness. And I must be a manifestation of that consciousness. And if I'm a manifestation of that consciousness, then when I'm more aware, it's because I'm more in tune. And when I'm less aware, it's because I'm less in tune. And I thought then, if that's the case, I must dedicate my entire life to finding more and more attunement with him. And I decided then and there that I would dedicate my life to seeking God. I didn't know what it was. In fact, I remember thinking at one point, maybe I'm going crazy, because no one in the world has ever sought God. I didn't know anything about the lives of saints and so on. I thought, maybe I'm just getting too weary with the world and I've got to get out in the country and be with simple country people. And I went out to Indian Lake in upstate New York, and I found the people there more dull than the people I knew in the cities. And I found, worst of all, that I didn't have the awareness that I wanted. I'd see the beauty of a raindrop with the sun in it, shining on a pine leaf. And I think it's beautiful, yes, but I can't feel it. What's the matter with me? I'm like an engine working on only one cylinder. And I thought, there's got to be something. And I came upon a book in my mother's library that said, it was called A Short World Bible. And in that book, I read different religions. And when I came upon the Hindu religion, I said, this is mine. It doesn't speak of one particular son of God or messenger of God or anything like that. It says that God is infinite, that it's a state of consciousness. And it said also, if you want to know me, go to a solitary place and meditate on me. And at that point, I resolved to give up everything and live in the forest, maybe in Brazil, because I thought maybe it would be cheap to live down there. And that was my ambition. Thank God I never got to fulfill it. I would have known what to do. I'd be sitting there cross-eyed and getting nowhere. But Yogananda came to my rescue. It was actually interesting how God helps you if you want to seek him, if you want to do his will. I've seen that many times in my life, that when I have brought God into the picture, he enabled me to achieve things that I could never have done on my own. In this case, what happened was that my father was sent to Egypt, to Cairo, as the oil representative of Esso or Exxon. And he went to explore in Egypt for oil. And the very day that I put my mother on the ship to go join him in Egypt, I went uptown New York to Doubleday Duran, as it was called then, on Fifth Avenue, and I saw a section on Indian books, and I saw the autobiography of a yogi, and the picture on the cover was so familiar, so felt like an old friend. And to make a long story short, when I bought that book, it was absolutely an earthshaker for me. I read it in just one sitting virtually. Of course, I had to go to bed, but still, the day after I read it, I took the next bus across the country. And as I was coming across the country, I was thinking, now I know how God can be found through Yogananda. And I thought, when I find him, I want to do my best to help everybody to know this wonderful teaching. So I went over with this twofold desire. And when I met him, it was in the Hollywood Church here in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard. And he accepted me that very day. The first words I said to him were, I want to be your disciple. And some people have said, well, what impression did you have of him? I said, I was too busy praying that he accept me to even bother with impressions. I was completely, I said, I can't even speak of my longing. I'd only weep. But I was saying, I know you know my thoughts, and you've got to accept me. And anyway, he did, and he said, I give you my unconditional love. Will you give me yours? I said, yes. Then he said, will you give me your unconditional obedience? Well, I wanted to be truthful. And so I had to say to him, what if I should think you wrong sometime? And he said, I will never ask anything of you that God himself doesn't first ask me. Tell me to ask you. And I said, in that case, I give you my unconditional love. And so he had me kneel before him and place his hand on my heart. And for 2 minutes, his arm vibrated, but it changed my life. And he came out onto the platform afterwards, and the few people who were left in the church, he said, "We have a new brother." From the very beginning, he always treated me as someone whom he wanted to take his teachings and take them out to the world. He often said to me, "You have a great work to do." And I want to tell people what it was like to be with him. In my books, I have tried to show that. In my talks here, I'd like to make it more dynamic in the sense by you hearing me say it in person. But something about his presence was so full of love and bliss. I can't imagine I couldn't have imagined such a thing. I used to be very short-sighted. In recent years, I've had that vibration, that operation on the eye that enabled you to see without glasses, and now I see very clearly. But then I couldn't, so I couldn't see his expression across the room. But I'd leave the room and look at him briefly, and such love poured out of him that really I turned away weeping. I couldn't help it. One time we were down in the basement, and Master was talking to some of the monks about holes that needed to be filled in the driveway because of a heavy rainstorm. And I didn't have to do that work because I was working on office work at that time. So I didn't have to. I just could close my eyes and meditate. And even while he was talking about such mundane things as filling potholes, I felt waves of bliss coming over me. It was an extraordinary thing. I've had the opportunity to meet quite a few saints in India, and very real saints. I remember, just by the way, there was somebody at this Big Sur Inn in Northern California, and I was telling him, I think maybe I've met as many as six people who knew God. He was a big bear of a man, and he said, "Jake, you just met the seventh." Well, in fact, I think it's more like 18. And all of them were wonderful people. I don't like to make comparisons. Comparisons can be odious. On the other hand, you can hardly reason without making comparisons. But I have to say this, without comparing in any negative way, Master was so real, so human. He didn't have to hold the world at a distance in order to preserve his own purity of mind and heart. He just embraced everybody. One time he was entering the lobby of a hotel. I don't know whether he had his orange robe on then or was dressed in more ordinary Western clothes, which he also did. But this man came up to him, very drunk, and he saw Master, and the first thing he said was, "Hello, Jesus Christ," and he embraced him. And Master said, "Hello there," and didn't say anything about scolding him or "don't touch me" or anything. He was just completely warm, and he thought, "Well, I'd like to shoot this man with a little touch of bliss." And the man sort of reeled. He said, "Shay, what are you drinking?" And Master said, "Well, I'll tell you this much. It has a lot of kick in it." And he left the man sober. But I saw him full of respect for everybody. None of the usual aloofness and so on. Not at all. Not the impression people are getting. He was so warm. And if he was stern, I've realized another thing in my life. The more you feel bliss, the more you become decisive. Your understanding becomes clear. And that decisiveness for people who are in ego consciousness can seem like ego, but it wasn't at all. I would look into his eyes and I'd see nothing but space. There was no ego there. I know Bernard was one of his teachers, and he was very egotistical, and he was always scolding Master, and Master didn't say anything, but after about 10 years of this, Master said to him one day, "You've been scolding me for many years. I just want to say this. I have only this to say. I am not impressed. But Bernard told me one time, if you ask me, old William isn't dead yet. That was a complete misunderstanding. It was Bernard's projection. People who think of Master as stern don't understand the compassion which made him be sometimes very firm with his disciples. But he wanted to help us to grow. You know, once you've met your guru and have been accepted by him, many people have said to me, do I need a guru? I said, no, don't even think of it. You don't need a guru. If, however, you reach the point where you know that you want God, then you need a guru. So there's no compulsion about it. But if you want to know God, the most important thing you've got to do is get rid of this sense of I am a separate person from other people. I am more important than other people. I even exist. You have to get rid of all that. And we can only do that by the help of somebody else. Remember in the Bible where it says, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. That power is the consciousness of Jesus, which he was by receiving. He didn't mean that you sign on the dotted line and say, yes, you're a Christian. He meant those who are in tune with that consciousness. That is the way to find God. You need the help of one who is in that consciousness, because only he can change your consciousness. You know, the ego can't get rid of itself. Itself is infected by the disease. Master told me the story of a man who was being bothered by a demon, and he had read in the scriptures, in the shastras, of a particular mantra that you should say when you have it bothered by a demon. Say these words into a little powder and then throw the powder on the demon. So the man tried this, and he threw it on the demon. Nothing happened. And the demon laughed. He said, before you could even say your mantra, I myself got into the powder. So how could it affect me? The story means it's the ego. To get rid of the ego, you can't do it with the ego. You have to let some other force come in to help you to understand. First of all, with glimmerings, like when I felt that bliss from Master, it was too real to ignore. But it helped me to shake my mind loose from other attachments, to realize more and more deeply that that's what I was. But you have to get it from a transferal from somebody who has that consciousness. If you want to be a good artist, mix with good artists. If you want to be a good writer of music, mix with good composers. If you want to be a good soldier, mix with good soldiers. If you want to be a good businessman, mix with successful businessmen. That power of magnetism is all over the world. And we must try to get onto that ray which will help us to become good at whatever we want to do. Your environment, as Master said, is stronger than willpower. But when it comes to knowing God, you need the help of somebody who knows God. Do you need only one guru? Well, that's another issue. I have been to many saints and have been very much helped by them. But I'm enough in tune with Master to know that this is my particular way, because there are many paths to God. And if you try to this path, and the other path, you can get lost in the middle. So it's better in the beginning to follow only one way, not for anybody's sake, but your own. But as you become strong in your own teaching, then I can be listening to all kinds of ways, because I know what the right way is for me. So with him, I found that my consciousness changed in ways that it would not have done. I used to, before I met him, it was like trying to perfect myself. It was like washing a dirty shirt, and you'd push the shirt under water, and a bubble's there, and it comes over here, so you push this one, comes up over here. And when you're trying to perfect yourself, you try to work on one quality, and then another aspect of your nature gets worse because you're not working on that. So you rush over here and try to perfect that, and this becomes worse. When doing it on your own, it takes forever, and you'll never get there anyway, because the ego cannot imagine, you can't imagine, what it would be like to be omnipresent, to realize that you exist at the heart of every atom, that you are center everywhere, circumference nowhere, as God himself is the step from human consciousness, human ego, being centered in one little body to becoming infinite. It's inconceivable for the ego. You know, the very interesting thing that he taught me also was that the ego is centered here in the medulla oblongata. When you see somebody who's very egotistical, he's always got his head back like this, sort of looking down his nose at people, being pulled back by the tension in the medulla oblongata at the base of the brain. And you will see people like that. Everything is from here. The more you watch this is the positive pole of that same center. The more your energy goes from this center to this one. When you are centered here, a master does everything from this center. And then you begin to feel completely different. You feel bliss in everything. You feel touched by everything. You feel that you are in everything. And that feeling becomes stronger and stronger. Now, most people think, well, after all, I am me. And who is me? Well, somebody who's selfish, who loves gold, who loves this or that or the other thing. And he has this and so that exact type of personality. When you understand who you are, you know that you're none of those things. You are the soul. And yet, once you find the soul, the amazing thing is that every single, Master put it in the autobiography of a yogi, every atom is dowered with individuality. When Master added to Shankaracharya's statement of the definition of God, ever-existing, ever-conscious joy, he added that phrase, ever new. It's an amazing thing, but that bliss is different in every single one. As every atom is individual, so every point of space is individual. You will never lose that individuality. This is a doubt that the ego has. But if I merge in God, won't I just become something else and lose who I am? The amazing thing is that you will find who you are. If you look at the lives of saints, you'll see that everyone is different. Most people are imitative in their actions, in their attitudes, because their neighbors think this way, they think this way. Because the neighbors do this, they do this. Americans act different from French, from Spanish, from others. But if you can understand who you really are, you'll find that you're completely different from everybody else, and your approach to life is different. Everybody's path to bliss is different. Everybody's experience of bliss is different. And yet it's the same bliss everywhere. It's an extraordinary truth, and one that could take up all your time if you understood how very thrilling, how very all-absorbing this truth is. Let me read to you from a few books that I have here. First of all, I hope I can read in this light. This is from Conversations with Yogananda. He used to have me write down what he said, and he had me with him when he had guests often, and I would write these things down. So a Columbia professor had a probing mind. Among many questions, he asked, how do you distinguish between yourself and your followers? Master replied, all are waves on the same and one ocean, composed as ocean water is of the same substance, spirit. Some of the values are higher than others. Some of the waves are higher. Some waves don't even want to distance themselves from the ocean. All waves, no matter how high, are in essence one and the same. The difference between the guru and the disciples, then, lies only in their respective closeness to the ocean. In how conscious each one is. This is very hard to read, I'm sorry. We need a light up here. It was that same professor, I believe, who posed a classic question. Which came first, the tree or the seed? Master said the tree came first. He answered without hesitation. As the idea of a deed precedes the deed itself, the tree was in this way a special creation. God, when he set the process in motion, gave the tree seeds that it might produce other trees like them. Everything at first, he added, is an idea in a special creation. I'm sorry, that'll help a lot. Okay. And then in another book, which I've called The Essence of Self-Realization, I once saw a cartoon drawing of a dog hitched to a small but well-laden cart. The dog's owner had found an ingenious method for getting it to pull the cart for him. A long pole tied to the cart extended forward over the dog's head. At the end of the pole, there dangled a sausage, temptingly. The dog, straining in vain to reach that sausage, hardly noticed the heavy cart he was dragging along behind him. How many business people are like that? They keep thinking, if I can make just a little more money, I'll find happiness at last. Somehow their sausage of happiness keeps receding from their grasp. As they strain to reach it, however, just see what a cartload of troubles and worries they drag along behind them. Possession of material riches without inner peace is like dying of thirst while bathing in a lake. If material poverty is to be avoided, spiritual poverty is to be abhorred. It is spiritual poverty, not material lack, that lies at the core of all human suffering. And this is from a new book that has yet to come out. It is called Living Wisely, Living Well, and is the reading for this particular day of the year, September 19th. You have within yourself the power to overcome all adversity. Even were you to be enslaved or thrown into a dungeon without hope of release, no one can possess or incarcerate your mind. If you cannot conquer a difficulty outwardly, rise above it inwardly. Seek freedom in your heart. No one can ever deny you that freedom. Were utter failure to crash upon you like a giant wave, know that God's law is ever benign and just. Place yourself in His hands, and everything must turn out eventually for the best. There's a beautiful story I read many years ago of somebody who was very wise and helped many people. And a young sort of student of his asked him one time for the secret of his wisdom. And the man said, I'll show you. And he took him into his bedroom, opened up a drawer, and showed him a very tiny, fragile seashell. It was perfectly formed, no break or anything in it. He said, many years ago, I used to be very rich, and I lost everything overnight in the great crash on Wall Street. And I was seriously thinking of committing suicide. And I sent my parent, my family off into the country, and I took a little house by the ocean. My plan was to go into the ocean and just walk out and let the water take me. And every time I tried to get into the water, waves would throw me back, and I'd fall on my knees and get up and try again. One time they threw me back, and I was on my hands and knees, and I saw this tiny little shell. And I thought, how is it that I can't move in this water, and this tiny shell is untouched? And I realized it had gone with the wave, not fought against the wave. And from then on, I've understood we must go with life, not work against it. And this is a lot of Master's teaching. I have spent my life, and part of my being here is to share this with you, that writing books that will help people in every walk of life to become successful and yet find happiness at the same time, whether it be in business, whether it be in education, whether it be in home life, in marriage, in all walks of life, all those hundreds, well, some 140 books, they're all with that intention of helping people in the modern age to show how this new age of energy will help them, if they will go with that energy and not fight it, to be more flowing in their lives and to be more giving and to be a part of an overall flow rather than thinking they've got to work only with their own egos. I've shown how less you think that you are doing it and more you think that he is doing it through you, the more you will find you can accomplish in this world. One time in the church in Hollywood, I suddenly thought in the middle of a sermon that Master had told me, let God talk through you. And so I thought, well, in that case, maybe what I should do is just shut up and let God talk. So I stopped speaking, just waiting calmly to see if God would say anything. And there was nothing. After 2 minutes of silence, people began perspiring. They thought I was frozen with fear. But instead, I was just comfortably waiting for God to say something. And finally, I had to recognize that he was not going to say it. He does everything in this world through instruments. And I, as Master said, I will reason, I will, I will act. But guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. I would like to urge all of you to try to understand that. Don't wait for other people to make things happen. Do your best to live this world in this world in such a way as to be a better person, to inspire other people to be better, and at the same time realize that it's with his power that you can do it, and without his power you can't do anything. So the more you can eliminate yourself and call on him to help you to do it, the more you will be able to do great good in this world. But the less you think of him doing it, the less good you'll create and the more confusion. So what I want to do is help people in Los Angeles, which is really, as I've said, as Master said, the spiritual center of America. I want very much to inspire the people of this city to become an uplifting force in the whole country and the whole world. You can do it. They say that one moon gives more light than all the stars. Just a few people, if they live right, can influence thousands. Don't think of yourselves as incompetent. He wants you to join the band of angels that are fighting for the light in this era when darkness is increasing and the world seems destined to even demolish itself the way it is going right now. We're coming into a very great depression. We're coming into the probability of world war. We're coming into a time where cities will probably be destroyed. People will live more and more in the country in simple communities like Ananda. And I hope through Ananda to offer an example of a group of people who can live harmoniously together, supportive of one another, and cooperatively. This is possible. We've shown it through 40 years of existence. And I want now to come out and tell everybody, go this way. The other way will be death. This is the way of life. Joy to all of you. Oh, now I want to ask you if you have any questions. So let me see. I can't hear a word, so I have to read it. I'm deaf as a post. So, did spirit have a beginning? Master said many people say that. That's because the thought of making things comes from human consciousness. God didn't make anything. He didn't make the universe. He produced it. He himself is ever-existent. And the universe, the consciousness behind the universe, nothing was created. Everything was only a manifestation. Please clarify the meaning of God made men in his image. Well, there's a very interesting thing, because in effect, Master said that in a way he did. The spiritual eye that you see in the forehead when you meditate deeply, in the center there's a five-pointed star. And man, if you put your arms out like this, he has two legs, two arms, and a head. Man is, in that sense, made in the image of God. More deeply, however, he has the capacity to know God, which the animals don't have. Man is made in the image of God because implanted in his heart is this divine bliss. And God, who has no form, actually doesn't have an image except in that spiritual eye. So the image is more beyond form in that formless bliss. Can you speak to the relationship between a karma and anxiety and depression? I find that my struggle with both seems to get in the way of my commitment to a spiritual path, but at the same time draws me to it, a crossroads. Did Master speak of these things? Well, he certainly did. He said that everything is a result of karma. I know that Daya said to him once, why did she have these moods of feeling depressed? Master said it comes from unfulfilled desires for material things in the past. Every time you desire something, every time you find happiness in something, you're going to have to experience its opposite. And those depressions and so on, it's all karmic. But if you keep your mind always on God, those moods of depression that do come to many people, you can gradually overcome it by learning to be even-minded under all circumstances. That is a practice which probably could involve many hours of discussion. Why does there seem to be no more miracles happening anymore? Well, I've seen a lot of miracles in my life. I'll tell you one that wasn't about Master, but a friend of mine, Hari Priya, was with Ananda Moyi Ma, a great woman saint, and she was wishing, she was sitting right before her, and wishing she had some fruit to offer to her. All of a sudden, a bunch of bananas materialized right on her lap, and she offered those to Ma. But with Master, there were many miracles he performed. I'll tell one that I've mentioned in one of the movies that I've written. It's called The Wayshower, and it's about him. It's about autobiography of a yogi, but as a story that can become have a real plot to it. And on this occasion, there was a group of about 10 or 12 guests, and he wanted to show them in Encinitas. He wanted to give them a taste of the carrot juice that they produce in their processing plant there. And so he told one of the monks to get some, and the monk said, "There's almost none right now. We only have enough for a little glass." The master said, "Never mind, bring that." And the disciple didn't know what he was going to do, but he brought it. And he kept filling everybody's glasses, and the glass still remained full. There are times when Master brought people back to life. There's a lot of them. All I'll say is that no miracles have not ceased. They continue. Is it too late?
Yeah. We should answer the rest next week.
I'll answer the rest next week. God bless you all.